Welcome to Sex with Simmery. Frank, occasionally explicit edutainment on the most important topic of all. Sex with Simmery is not intended for children and is not safe for work unless your boss is particularly awesome. See more at sexwithsimmery.com.
If you enjoy steamy podcasts, you'll want to tune in to the Swinging MILF Podcast with me, Sally Swings, where I keep it real and I dish out the juicy details of my sexy adventures, hard lessons learned, and have guests join me to discuss hot topics all about the swinger lifestyle. Add it today to your sexy podcast playlist. Go to theswingingmilf.com/podcast or search for The Swinging MILF Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Blueberry. As a word of caution, this show isn't shy when it comes to sex. I get down to business, so there is a clothing optional dress code.
Welcome to Sex with Simmery. This is Dr. Simmery. I am super excited to introduce to you our next guest. Today, we have on the show Christina Irene. How are you doing?
I am marvelous. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm excited to talk to you today because, like, you're going to be bringing up a bunch of stuff that is really relevant to the show, and especially like right now. I want to hear about all the stuff you do because you are a speaker and trainer around women's empowerment, and I want to know, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Well, actually, you know what? I started out in my own kind of personal mission with, I'm a writer. I'm an unpublished writer, so don't try to find me on Amazon yet. I'm all about empowerment. You know, I've gotten to a point in my life where I realize that I can just do whatever I want, and that I believe in myself and I know I can accomplish the things I want. And I really want to tell everybody, like, hey, you can do what you want. So I'm primarily about empowerment. But, you know, women's empowerment is something really special for me because I had to come to my present position of empowerment from a very real disadvantage. And that is being a woman and the things I had to experience as a woman. And women do tend to get sidelined at times, or, you know, we're told that, oh, you can't do that because that's not appropriate. And also, we're less bold. I mean, you know, my background is my first career was in stand-up comedy, and there's so many more men than there are women. And women are just, I think, trained by society to be more reserved and to not speak out. Don't make fart jokes, you know?
So you were a traveling comedian, and there are not a lot of women in that field. So what was that like?
It was interesting. And I was, I think, my entire time when I was touring full time, which was about 3 or 4 years, and it was like my income. I was in my early 20s. So I was like just finishing college and just getting out of college. And I only ever worked with another touring woman my age one time.
What?
So I was a very, very unique, and I didn't have anybody to talk to about, like, have my experience and, like, how do I do this and how do I do that. And I got to realize that things were very different for me, and I tried to talk to my friends about it, and all my friends were male comedians. And they didn't believe me. And there's one guy, he's still a good friend of mine. He just constantly was like, oh, you got a chip on your shoulder. You got a chip on your shoulder. I'm like, no, man, it's different. And only twice did any of my friends actually realize how different it was for me. And then once they saw it, it was like this big moment. They came to me. They're like, wow, Christina, like, you really do have it a lot different. I said, yeah, I do.
What were those instances? What was their aha moment?
You know, I can't even remember what gave each of them the aha moment. I think one of them actually, like, witnessed or heard somebody saying things about me, And that kind of triggered it because it was not while he was around me. He kind of came to me. We hadn't done any shows together or anything like that. He kind of came to me later and he was like, yeah, you know what? You're right. All that stuff that you say about things being different for you. That's true.
So what was your perception? How did you feel like you were being treated differently?
So one is audience perception. So, you know, people will just think that women aren't as funny as men. I had people come up to me after a show. Like, I was doing a show in Alabama, and this guy comes up to me after the show, and he's like, you know, as a rule, I don't like female comics. You're pretty good.
Okay.
I'm like, as a rule, I don't like assholes, but you're all right, too. Yeah. So, you know, there is that. And especially, this is terrible, but I always hated it whenever I had to follow another female comedian. Not like I didn't hate following her, but like when I showed up and I found out that there was going to be a female opener, it just made me cringe at first because, you know, if it's two males and the first guy's not that funny, then the audience is like, all right, let's see the next guy. If it's two females and the female who goes up first isn't funny, then the audience goes, women aren't funny. And then you got to follow that with that perception. And it's a little tougher.
Mm. So,
and it's just any case, like when something's, you know, when somebody's rare, they just kind of assign it to the whole group. You know, if you're the only one that they know who's doing this one thing, they see somebody else who's like you, who's unique. They think that, you know, they apply it across the board.
Yeah. I mean, that I think is like a conversation we've had on the show before about just in terms of representation, right? So sometimes on the show, it's come up in the context of like, 50 Shades of Grey. This is a weird analogy, but 50 Shades of Grey, for some people, very, very enjoyable. For some people, it's the way that they got introduced to their own kinks and was their first foray into BDSM. For a lot of people in the kink community, they were like, this is a garbage fire because these things are wrong about it. This is inaccurate and the writing's bad or whatever.
And, oh, wow.
And it's like for so many people, you know, this was like a big deal. This was a game changer for them. And so that should be happy. But the problem is there's so few representations of kink. There's so few representations of BDSM in the media that it's like people feel like they can't afford to have bad ones out there or inaccurate ones out there.
So
like
yeah.
When there's just like not a lot of black women on TV and there's just not a lot of, you know, like Asian movie stars, then you end up with a situation like Ghost in the Shell and you got a white woman playing a Japanese character and it's like this circle of self-fulfilling prophecy. So like you keep booking the same kind of people to keep confirming that other people can't do that work. And so
yeah
the importance of representation. Oh, there goes.
And you know what? I actually, 50 Shades of Grey, I have 2,000 books in my house and I have that book in my library and I don't know if I'll ever pick it up and read it. And it's just because I heard it was bad writing and I'm a writer and I'm just not sure I can handle that. I don't mind the subject matter at all, but, yeah, I'm afraid to read it and have it be bad writing.
So I'm super curious why you bought it then.
No, I didn't. But it was actually a gift to my mom from my stepsister. And then she just gave it to me when she was done reading. It was hilarious because she's like, yeah, I read this in the bathroom.
Okay. All right. That's
she's like, it was
know.
Okay. I'm like,
all right. All right, Mom. All right.
Okay. And my mom doesn't really read books. So the whole thing was just hilarious and bizarre. But yeah, my mom gave it to me.
I'm also curious, as a female comedian, like how that affects what topics you touch. Like knowing that, you know, your gender presentation is an inescapable part of the audience experience of you. How does that affect what you talk about?
That's a really good question. I was endlessly fascinated while I was doing comedy about the nuances of just psychology and perceptions and all that. So one of the things I had to figure out, and one thing that made it really tough, and it's hard to say this and present this, and this is one of the struggles I always had trying to get people to relate and understand what I was going through. But I was a, you know, I was in my early 20s and I was a cute girl. So, and I'm like, I'm short, I'm fair skinned, you know, I have strawberry blonde hair, I have this kind of angelic face, and that has a certain perception and certain expectations that come with it. And it's, you know, if I, looking innocent as I do, for me to say, you know, shit on stage is a bigger contrast and a bigger thing unexpected than, you know, if a big burly guy would say it too. And it just, so I got perceived as a little bit dirtier than I was just by doing PG-13 material. And I quickly learned that I had to be as clean as possible because otherwise it was just shocking.
Well, I guess the other option would be, I guess, the sort of Sarah Silverman route, which is that you say the unexpected, like overly offensive thing, right? And then you just let people like sit with that, like...
I'm curious if I could ever pull that off. I mean, she has a totally different look than me. She does not look angelic girl next door.
Okay, that's fair.
She doesn't have, you know, she, well, I still, I don't have like a, I actually have the voice of a 12-year-old boy. so there, at least I have that going for me. But yeah, just like height and everything. It was, when I was a high school teacher, it was nonsense. It was really hard to get mean with the kids, but I did. And it was shocking when I did. But yeah, I noticed prejudices of society whenever I was performing and noticing how people reacted differently to different entertainers. For example, society has different expectations based on gender. Like people expect women to be nicer. People expect women to be more demure, and they get more easily offended, especially males and older males. And even, you know, just anybody who's in the 60 plus in the audience would get a little bit more sensitive to me going blue. But a male comedian, since, you know, men aren't held to the such high standards, it's not shocking and it's not offensive as much whenever they talk about things like that. And what's also interesting is racism, because people will be more easy hearing a black person talk about, you know, dirty material and cuss and swear, and a black woman could be dirtier than me because society overall is racist and holds black people to lower standards than they do white people.
That's really interesting, because I'd be sort of expecting something else, that like because of respectability of politics, people would hold black folks to like some sort of properness standard. But it could also just be like stereotypes, like expectations of like what people are going to talk about in general and like what their experience, like, you know, I don't know, like it could be really interesting how that stuff like sorts out, because it's like it's all stereotyping, and whatever happens can just confirm your expectation, right? Like,
yeah, it's totally stereotyping. It totally is.
All right. That's great.
There's so much stereotyping. And the thing is that I was working, you know, I wasn't working. I didn't do shows in New York City and in LA. I was on the road. So I was doing shows at a military base in, you know, North Dakota, or, you know, in some dive in Kentucky. And I was seeing America as they are. And, you know, different people in different regions. And it was really interesting study of sociology to be on the road and see how people respond to people.
And I've also heard from a few other folks that I'm friends with that are comedians, like what lands in different areas totally changes, right? So like one friend, for instance, he said like when he was in Portland, Oregon, he had just cut out anything that made him sound like he was mean. Like their level of tolerance for like snark and like that sort of thing, which is very low. And then,
oh,
like,
that's a shame.
And then he's like in Philly, and like that's the bread and butter, right? Is like this, yeah, this sort of like rough grittiness. So there's also, yeah, that is like sensibility.
Yeah. Well, I in the South, people were really, really nice, and they were really laid back, and they're quick to laugh. But now I got to be careful saying this. I lived down South for 9 years, and I have like people who are near family to me down South. But if you look at where the states rank as far as education goes, you're going to get your lower ranks down south. And sometimes in Alabama, they could be a little slower to get the really witty stuff.
Okay. Alabama, so, she's throwing shade at you. I don't know if you caught that.
Actually, there's some really cool places in Alabama, but there's one town I was in that I just hated the whole town. I went to Target, and this lady shoulder checked me to butt in line to get to the dressing room before me. I was just trying to kill time. And I went to do my show, and the club owner comes up to me, and I've been doing comedy for 7 years at this point. And he comes up to me before the show, and he starts giving me this condescending lesson on how to hold the microphone. And then he came and sat front and center with his arms crossed.
Ew.
While I started my show, watching me until I got my first couple of laughs, and then he went about his business.
Ew. What is that? Yeah.
Oh, and the hotel room was so sketchy too. Like, they always put you up in a hotel room and they get you the cheapest of the cheap. It's terrible. And there's like mysterious white powder on the table, and there's like a half drank beer in the fridge and dead bugs, and then the door lock wasn't working right. And the maintenance guy had to let me in, and I'm just like, and I actually had a hangover that day, too, so I was super grumpy. And then the phone starts ringing, and it's this raspy guy going, "Is Cotton there?" And I was like, "No, there's nobody here named that." And he goes, "Well, this is room 243, isn't it?" And I'm thinking, oh, my God, that's my room number. And I'm just like, yeah. And he goes, "Is Cotton there?"
So what you're telling me.
I got a friend in Atlanta, and I called him, and I'm like, "I'm staying at your house tonight."
Yeah, so I'm pretty much sold on the life of the traveling comedian at this point. Actually, one of the things that I always want to ask comedians, right? So there's a lot of certainly dudes that I've known who went into comedy because that's how they were going to get laid. They were not going to get laid some other way. It was going up on stage and showing off that particular strength of theirs, their witticism, their like ability to turn things into funny stories. And prior to that, they weren't necessarily slaying. Now, that's not to say that that's why everybody goes into comedy or that everybody goes into comedy like gets hella laid. But I am curious what your perspective is on that.
Oh, comedy adds 2 to 3 numbers. So if you're a 6 and you're doing comedy, you're suddenly a 9. Yeah. It's same with being a teacher, I think. You know, think about it. Think about how average the hot teacher actually was.
Interesting. Because you just, like, don't have any other options, and they're also, like, that power.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, like, it's just being an adolescent and having hormones. I'm not sure. But
There's that.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So on the road, yes, the guys were, a lot of them were that cliche, you know, nailing the waitresses kind of like comedian. There was a lot of that. In fact, I checked into, so they don't always put you up in a crack hotel. Sometimes they put you up in what's called the comedy condo, which is an apartment that they rent out. And I stayed in a couple nice ones, but a lot of them were, think about the furniture that's set out at the curb that's free. And I traveled with my own cleaning supplies.
Oh.
Yeah, I remember spending 2 hours sterilizing a bathroom one time when I got to a comedy condo. Where was I going with this? So whenever you work a comedy club, you're basically beneath the beer as far as your importance. So whenever you get there, they're not like, "Hey, welcome. What can we do for you? We're so glad you're here." You know, I mean, I've done comedy at colleges as well, and they are like that. They're super nice, and that's how speaking is. But so I stayed in a comedy condo, and there was a list, and I wish I had this picture. And it was basically the rules of the condo, and it was, you know, how to make sure you lock up, where things are. And it was, and then the rules of like, when you get to the club, don't solicit drugs, don't hit on the waitresses. Like, this actually had to be written on paper that everybody who stayed there had to read. And it was about not sleeping with the waitresses. That was like number 27 on there.
Well, okay. I mean, I guess if you're a waitress, maybe you want that. Maybe you don't want to be harassed at work. It could very easily go either way. Like, If you out there have a thing for comedians, you know, the option of being a waitress at a comedy club, that's going to put you in the right spot. But, you know, waitresses also do get hella harassed at work. Like, everybody thinks that they're there to get a date and that getting asked out is just as good as a tip. It's not. It's not, though.
No. Yeah, I waited tables for a while. But I was, like, at a family restaurant in Tennessee. So instead of tips, I got Bible tracts.
Oh, good. That'll pay your rent. That's very helpful. That's going to do you so much good.
So yeah, the a lot of the male comedians were definitely out there trying to get laid, living that lifestyle. A lot of them, I think, were comedians because it was the one job they could get where they didn't have to pass a piss test. And they didn't want to get up in the morning, just that kind of thing.
I mean, I don't want to get up in the morning. So, like, I empathize. I empathize greatly. I want to also make sure that we talk about one of the other things that you do around empowerment and speaking and training. You also talk about invisible disabilities, and that is super interesting to me. So, what are you doing around that?
Well, we just started talking about sex. Isn't that what your show is about? No, I'm just kidding.
We're gonna always talk about sex. Don't worry, I'm gonna bring it up again.
So invisible disabilities, is basically, it could be any mental, invisible disability, like, depression, ADHD, PTSD. There's a list of a million things, physical invisible disabilities. I'm giving examples. I'm not defining it. It's a disability that you have that, when somebody looks at you, they don't know you have it just by looking at you. So people with disabilities, you think of as people with mobility aids, so wheelchair, crutch, something like that. Or you can, you know, physically see some kind of symptom of their invisible disability or of their disability. For invisible disabilities, not the case. So, like, I have fibromyalgia and a couple other things going on. So that's an invisible disability because you don't know I have it just by looking at me. So I'm trying to bring awareness about that because there's a lot of, well, people just, there's stigmas attached to it. You know, I can tell you there's certain things. Sorry, my brain gets a little slow sometimes. Remember, I just said I had fibromyalgia. So we'll just use that. I do get tired. But there are stigmas surrounding invisible disabilities, like people who have bipolar disorder. You know, it's like a punchline, and it's not something that people are sensitive to, that it's something people really struggle with. And I'm just trying to bring awareness and try to take away that shame and that blame. And I really want people to be able to be out and open about their invisible disabilities. Like, people don't want me to hear me talk about the fact that I have fibromyalgia. And, you know, some people... just, I could tell them I have it and explain to them what it is, and they still say, oh, well, you know, we all have aches and pains, or, oh, well, I'm tired too. I'm thinking, no, you jerk, I have a disease.
So what do you think that is? Like, what do you think the discomfort is talking about those sort of things? Like, is it just the same as discomfort talking around, you know, like, apparent disabilities?
Well, I think a lot of it is, well, people don't want to, like, for me, I don't want people to think I'm a whiner, you know, like that I'm just complaining. I don't like to be negative about things. If I do bring up my disability, it may be just to try to explain something like, hey, I just, you know, stuttered just now because, you know, I have cognitive issues related to this disability that I have. Or, you know, I really can't go out Saturday night because I feel a flare up coming on. You know, I try to just keep it like, you know, this is what's happening and this is why it's happening. But I don't ever want to be perceived as a whiner. So, and people don't really want to hear about it because they don't know what to say or what to do. Mm. You know, whenever somebody's going through something and you're just like, I don't know what to do. Like, can I help you in any way? And there's no way to help, or do you need a hug, or what are you supposed to do? And then it's like this awkward position that they're in. And I think that may be the aversion, but you know, other people who have, like, think about it, like depression, like, do you really want to tell somebody that you have depression? people get afraid to tell their employers that they have, you know, a mental health disability because they're afraid that they're going to be, you know, judged or not put up for a promotion or thought of, you know, not able to do their jobs. And we just kind of keep it to ourselves.
So what do you advocate for instead? Like what the course of the work that you're doing, the awareness raising, what do you recommend to folks who either have an invisible disability? Like what would you suggest for them about coming out and empowering them? And then for folks who do not, what do you recommend when you hear that someone does?
Well, the biggest thing is just like awareness and acceptance. And I kind of advocate for, you know who your people are and be willing to be the person. So, you know, how you have your person that you can talk to about anything, that, you know, and then there's people that you can't. So just try to identify the people that you can be open with and hold them close. And if you don't, if you're somebody trying to be supportive, then you can be the person that is willing to listen. And it's just basically awareness is about awareness, and just simply being aware does so much. You know, being sensitive to not make fun of somebody, to if somebody says, no, I can't do something, like if I say, hey, I can't go out tonight, I'm not feeling well, I don't want you to pester and bug me and say, oh, yes, come on, you got to do it, you got to do it. And it's bad enough that I'm missing out on the fun. It's even worse that you're nagging me about it. And let's see your question. Sorry, I'm trying to get back to it.
So both in terms of people with invisible disabilities, like how you would empower them to come out, and then also how to be supportive in response.
Okay, so empowering people to come out is just, it really comes down to courage and just being fearless and not worrying about what people think. And that's actually a big thing that I talk about my women's empowerment as well, is how to get past your fears and how to get past those things that hold you back. And I actually have this whole thing that I take people through, and I you know, relate to, like, what's your most embarrassing moment? Oh, hey, you survived that. You know, why do you let the fear of something you already know that you survived stop you from doing something that you really want to do? And another thing that I talk about for people who suffer from an invisible disability is, you know, understanding. Look, we're getting. I'm trying to keep this top level, not getting too deep into things. You know, one thing that is really great is to remember that things come in cycles. Like, there's. You know how you have your high moments in your life and you have your low moments in your life, and everything's just cyclical. So when you're in a low moment, just to remember that those high moments are still coming about. It's a great thing to keep in mind. You know, another like coping mechanism that I like to teach is getting lost in something. Like anytime you're doing something that you get totally engrossed in and you forget about time and everything else, to keep track of what those things are and find ways to get back to those whenever you're struggling with something. And I actually teach universal coping mechanisms. So whenever I talk about like awareness and how to help people and how to cope, I get into, you know, universal concepts that are good for anybody to use.
So what would that include? What would be an example of that?
The universal concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, like what I just said, you know, remembering that things come in cycles, and, you know, knowing who you can talk to and being the person that somebody can talk to. And another big one is, you know, for somebody who's not dealing with a disability, but who's has a friend or somebody close to them who is, and this is huge, is to not be a fixer, you know, how people will try to find a solution or try to fix your problem for you. And this actually tends to be more of a male trait than a female trait. I've noticed just in personal experience is, you know, men like to fix things. They want to identify the problem and they want to solve it. And women, we just want to like talk about it and be emotional about it and experience it. You know what I mean? So to not be a fixer is to, okay, I use myself as an example again. When people are say, oh, Christina, you have fibromyalgia. Well, I just read this article online that it could be mold. And, you know, they're sending me links and all this stuff. And they're like trying to cure me. And I'm like, I don't want you to cure me because you can't. You know, I just want you to know I have this and just be sensitive.
That seems very practical. I can definitely get out of that.
And that's a universal thing in life. Like, I learned this when I was in my mid-20s. I actually almost adopted a teenager.
Whoa.
And I wanted to be a fixer. I wanted to make her life perfect, and I wanted to do everything for her and, you know, have everything be okay. And it didn't work. And I won't get into the personal details of the story because, you know, we're still in touch and all that. But we ended up going our separate ways because of the way circumstances played out. And I realized that I was not going to be able to fix this person and make her who I wanted her to be, but I could still love her and, you know, be there and be a present person in her life. So that was a tough lesson to learn. And being a teacher, that was all over the place. You know, you have all these students, they have all these things happening in their lives. You can't fix them. You can't just, and you want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I am like, yeah, I would like, I'm like, put on a cape. I'm gonna fly around. I'm
so
gonna scoop
so
up all the gay kids and be like, you all right, it's gonna be okay. And I'm
acceptance.
Gonna just...
Yeah. So I need people like accept that I have a disability. It's okay. I accept it. I'm good. You know, I'm fine. I'm happy. I'm living my life. I'm doing pretty much anything I would do otherwise. I mean, sometimes I'm a little slow. Like sometimes during our conversation, I get a little slow, but that happens. But, you know, I still do everything I want to do. So it's just acceptance. So if people around me can just accept that I have this thing, that's so huge. It's so helpful.
That's awesome. So you do training and speaking and all that kind of stuff. So if folks want to find out more about you and about your work and all this kind of stuff, where can we direct them?
I have a website. It's ChristinaIrene.com. So that's Christina, three syllables, Christina, spelled with a C-H. Irene, like somebody's grandmother's name. ChristinaIrene.com. And I have on there about my speaking for my women's empowerment, for my leadership, invisible disabilities awareness. If you dig a little deeper, you can even see some stuff about my stand-up comedy.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for finding time to talk to us and late at night when you are normally sleeping and taking
well,
care
really
of yourself.
Sleeping, I'd be normally curled up and with my dog in my bed reading a book. And right now I'm actually with my dog in my bed.
Well, give that dog a hug. That's fantastic. We have a studio cat here. When we record the podcast, there's a cat that wanders around.
Oh, cool.
And occasionally just bats at my feet. So that's nice, too. So, yeah, I want to thank you, Christina, for finding time to talk to us. And we're going to let you curl up with your dog and get plenty of rest. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
And thank you to everyone for listening. And have a fantastic day. Hey, friends and family of Sex with Timory. We are so grateful to have your listenership. We have the coolest fans in the world. It's pretty much the best. And we hope that the love is mutual. If you are interested in supporting the Sex with Timory media, either the website, the podcast, head on over to patreon.com/sexwithtimory and become a supporter. For as little as $1 a month, you can be a regular supporter and continue to bring independent media that provides the kind of information that you want to have out in the world. Over here at Sex with Timory, we have been doing this stuff for years. As you've noticed, we've got over 200 episodes. The Sex with Timory website has been up since 2008. We've been giving you the goods for absolutely no cost, and we will continue to do so as long as we can. So thank you so much for your listenership, and we do hope that you will check it out. Patreon.com/sexwithtimory. Thank you for listening to Sex with Timory. Sex with Timory, the podcast, is produced by Nathan Karuna. Our opening music is by Charles Evans. Our closing music is by Hanya Lee. Be sure to check out sexwithtimory.com, Sex with Timory on Facebook, and tweet at me, Timory_LEIGH. If you're a fan of the show, if you like it at all, a little bit maybe even, rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends all about it. And thank you.